Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
Our campaign has been laser-focused on the issues that are important to everyday Arizonans, and those are not Republican or Democratic issues. Those are just bread-and-butter issues that people worry about every day.
I've worked closely with President Trump to cut taxes for working families, create jobs, secure the border, honor our veterans, and when I'm in the Senate, I'll work with him to confirm judges who uphold the Constitution.
I'm hoping that educators and, you know, public school advocates are still fired up, whether it's Prop 205 or the superintendent's race or the governor's race or any state legislature, that they're looking at who's pro-public education, not whether they're Democrats or Republicans, but whether they support schools and whether they support funding our school.
We're a competitive state when it comes to our tax policy. We have the 28th highest income tax rates for small businesses and income. It was a very poorly drafted initiative that would have put our economy into cardiac arrest, while, by the way, doing nothing to improve education in the state of Arizona.
He transformed American politics. He crossed party lines. He did what he thought was right, even when it wasn't popular.
My name's Joe Biden. I'm a Democrat. And I love John McCain.
And with us to talk about the passing of Senator McCain, along with the results of Arizona's primary election and what we learned, our Arizona Republic columnist Bob Robb and longtime political reporter Jim Small. Guys, thanks for being here.
Good morning. With you.
Bob, you knew John McCain for more than three decades. Based on your observations of having met him when you did in the 80s and what he went on to do in the Senate, any things that surpassed your expectations, I suppose, when we think about based on having met him, or did you think that he had the ambition and the drive to turn into one of the most famous senators in the country?
I think from the get-go, it was clear that John McCain was different. He was different to the electorate because of his experience as a prisoner of war. And he had a drive and an energy and a passion that is rare even in politics. He defeated in his first primary campaign, much better known, longtime state legislators, and he did raise more money because he was a national figure, but he also outworked them and won decisively. And it was fairly clear from that point on that he was a special political persona, and bright things were expected. I probably wouldn't have anticipated that he would have contended for the presidency twice, but that he was a longtime influence in the U.S. Senate and a substantial figure on the international stage wasn't a surprise at all.
Since we're not going to talk about Senator McCain for much of this segment, I want to ask a quick sort of follow-up about Arizona politics. He obviously was extremely popular, won elections very easily most of the time, and yet there was still that internal fight. The real activist members of the state party, the Maricopa County Republican Party, especially after, it seemed like maybe before the Gang of Eight, but in terms of immigration or whatnot, really seemed to have a problem with McCain. How much did he actually dominate the state Republican Party?
There were periods of time in which he dominated it quite substantially, other periods of time in which his influence waned and his opponents rose. It really began in the 2000 presidential race. He had always been an acceptable figure from the social conservative standpoint. He supported their causes. It wasn't his top priorities, but he was perfectly acceptable. And after what happened to him in South Carolina, he gave a speech that denounced the social right in very aggressive terms. And that was when the social right began to have some suspicions about the extent to which he was being straight with them, paradoxically, for the Straight Talk Express. And then you have the hardliners on immigration, and that's about a third of the Republican electorate. And McCain twice championed comprehensive immigration reform, including legal status for those who are here illegally. So those were the causes of the suspension and the tension. But it was never enough to defeat him in a Republican primary. And he fit the state of Arizona of his era in much the same way that Barry Goldwater fit the state of his era.
Jim, Bob mentioned McCain's sort of national profile and national persona, even from the get-go. I'm wondering, when you look at some of the issues specific to Arizona, what do you look at as some of those that he worked on that are maybe most impactful, or maybe his legacy will be felt most into the future?
Well, I think no doubt he rose Arizona's profile. He brought Arizona up to a more national profile and in a way that didn't involve the Daily Show or things like that, you know, lawmakers driving 100 and some odd miles an hour down a freeway. He was a positive, you know, I think he reflected positively on Arizona on the national stage and, you know, was in a lot of ways, sure, certainly elected from Arizona, but, you know, I think he was one of those very infrequent and rare national politicians, those people who you almost think of as kind of like, you know, the nation's senator in a lot of ways. I mean, he represented, kind of that throwback time. And we heard a lot of that, in the speeches, the funeral, and Vice President Biden, in particular, talked about that, about that willingness and the approach to governing and disagreeing without being disagreeable to go back to the Goldwater. And I think those are the things that I think most acutely are going to be missed in terms of working on Arizona-specific policies. I don't know that he did that as much. I mean, for a long time, you had Senator Kyle, John Kyle, who did a lot of those very Arizona-specific things and really worked hard in the Senate to make sure that policy affecting Arizona was handled responsibly and in a way that benefited the state, while Senator McCain was much more like kind of the national figure and taking up those issues as national security issues and things of that ilk.
So when you look at Arizona losing Senator McCain in the Senate, given what you said about how he sort of raised Arizona's profile nationally, you were losing a lot of seniority, 30-plus years in the Senate. What does that mean for Arizona's influence maybe nationally and maybe the ability of some of the issues here to get some of that national attention with him gone?
Oh, I think it's certainly going to diminish it. I mean, if you look at it, we're going to go from a situation where we had a Senator Kyle and a Senator McCain, the two people who had, long tenures in Congress and were well-respected legislators, to a situation now where, I mean, you've got the flake seat who served one term. It's now coming open, and it's going to be filled by somebody who has some experience in Congress, but in the other chamber, and it are still junior members, and now you're going to have someone who's appointed to this McCain seat, and we'll see where that goes and who gets appointed to it, and whether it's a caretaker who's just going to sit in the seat for a couple of years until the next election, or if it's going to be someone who's going to be position to hold that seat long term. But I think there's no doubt that Arizona definitely loses some of its influence in the U.S. Senate.
Bob, is that a fair assessment? Arizona gets maybe knocked down a little bit, losing this seniority and institutional knowledge?
Certainly to begin with. But I think both McSally and Sinema have the capability of becoming highly effective U.S. senators. McSally, if she gets elected, has some star power of her own in terms of the first combat female pilot. While she's been in Congress, she's worked on Arizona issues. She's immersed herself in details. She wants to have a profile on national security. So I see her very much following the John Kyle model, and I think she's got the capabilities to do that. And she will have a bit of a superstar status that will give her a boost up, the same as McCain had. Sinema, I think, very well could follow the Dennis DeConcini model. DeConcini is not usually regarded in the same ranks as McCain or Kyle or Carl Hayden, but he was a very effective senator, particularly on Arizona issues, and did it by working across the aisle. I think Sinema has the capability of doing that, and if she is to win Arizona, the Democrats will be desperate for her to be able to keep Arizona. And so even though she won't have the star power that Martha McSally has, the Democrats will want to see her boosted and be able to be seen as delivering for Arizona. So I actually think both McSally and Sinema have the ability to be very good senators and to get sort of a head start in what can be a fairly hidebound institution like the U.S. Senate.
Bob, I want to follow up on one thing based on those particular subjects. We're coming into a time where, as we see the Colorado River, that's becoming even more of a place of conflict potentially based on how much water Arizona is going to need. So I guess I would follow up on that to say that sometimes Senator McCain was criticized for not being quite as entrenched with the Arizona issues, but he had Senator Kyle, perhaps Senator Flake, was more involved in those things as well. So when it comes down to the timing of certain things like water, how troubling could that be without the seniority?
It could be troubling, but right now that's a negotiation between the states, and it's the governor's race, where I think Arizona's moxie in those discussions is most at stake. I do believe that either McSally or Sinema, they're very bright, they're very quick studies. I think that they would get on top of those issues quickly. And as I said, there's reason for both parties to want whichever one of them wins to be successful.
And that allows us to segue into our next topic. It's the Friday Newscap here on the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Bob Robb and Jim Small. Jim, let's look at that U.S. Senate race in terms of what we're seeing based on what happened on Tuesday night. Martha McSally won, which we ultimately expected would happen, beating Kelly Ward and Joe Arpaio. And, of course, Kyrsten Sinema had Deirdre Abboud and won handily. Based on what we saw even the last few days leading up to the primary, the fact we're seeing the ads, Sinema had already had her ads touting herself as an independent. Now we're seeing the pink tutu ad with Martha McSally, really contrasting that. Based on the early observations as we head into the general, what are you seeing there?
I think it was very clear that the McSally campaign felt comfortable, you know, a week, 10 days or so before the primary election, that they knew where they were at and that they were going to move to the general, and that they were getting ready to, you know, basically turn their sights to their likely general opponent in Kyrsten Sinema. This is going to be, you know, I think a pretty brutal race. I mean, I think both parties really need this seat, and the Democrats see this as a huge advantage to being able to take over the Senate. It's an essential piece for them to win the Senate. If they're going to kind of shoot the moon and make that happen, they have to get Arizona. Republicans, I think, are obviously don't want to lose a seat that they've held for a long time, and in what has traditionally been a deep red state like Arizona. I think the conventional wisdom right now is still that Kyrsten Sinema probably has the advantage, at least coming into the election right now. I think most people view her as the favorite to win. But there's a lot of campaigning that's going to happen fast and furiously here in the next, you know, 6 weeks until we kind of get to the early voting in the general.
Do either of you think we learned anything during the primary in either the Republican or Democratic side that we didn't know either about the candidates or how what we thought we knew about the general race would go?
I think we learned that Martha McSally likes Donald Trump an awful lot, which I don't think anyone would have predicted 18 months ago.
We also learned that she's an extremely tough and effective campaigner. I think that the challenge that she will pose to Kyrsten Sinema has been underestimated.
Well, and I want to jump in on that too, because Jim, I think the conventional wisdom may say that Sinema, at least at this point, based on the fact she's been able to portray herself as an independent and a moderate, has worked very hard at that and has been in Congress longer than Martha McSally. But Bob, you love to write about this, and you did it just the other day, the registration disadvantage that Democrats have. How well would Sinema have to do with independents to win this seat?
A Democrat, well, let me set the context. In 2014, the last time we had an off-presidential race, there were about 190,000 more Republicans vote than Democrats. The Democrats have reduced it since then, although they've stagnated since 2016. My guess is that there'll be roughly 150,000 more Republicans vote than Democrats. So to win, a Democrat has to have an increased Democratic turnout than usually occurs, has to have a large independent turnout, needs to win the independent turnout at least 60-40, and probably needs some kind of a never-Trumper crossover Republican vote. I don't share the view that Sinema is the favorite. Those are, since people who are still registered Republican or Democrat, given the rise in independent registration, tend to be immensely brand loyal. And in the last several elections, Republicans have been over 40% of those who turn out to vote. Those are just overwhelming demographic odds. I believe this is a year in which those odds can be overcome, and Sinema is extremely well positioned to overcome them, but they're still daunting odds.
Yeah, I will say with regard to the turnout, one of the things we did see in the primary election was significantly more enthusiasm from Democratic primary voters than from Republican primary voters, which is compared to where it was 2 years ago in terms of number of votes cast in a Democratic primary in a particular precinct versus in a Republican primary.
And that is
an indicator. It's a leading indicator. It's by no means a predictor that there's an enthusiasm gap that's happening, you know, that Democrats are more engaged and a little bit more enthusiastic, certainly than they were 2 years ago. Whether they have enough more enthusiasm to overcome that numerical advantage remains to be seen.
And this is one of the cases in which I think there has been an exaggeration and a lack of context. It is true that you had a larger Democratic turnout than the traditional Democratic turnout, but there were still 117,000 more people who voted in the Republican primary for governor than voted in the Democratic primary for governor, even though the Democrats had a real race. So while Democratic turnout was better compared to Democratic turnout historically, there were still overwhelmingly more Republicans who voted in the primary than Democrats.
That's Bob Robb with the Arizona Republic. Also here with us is longtime political journalist Jim Small. Now we turn to Southern Arizona for a few minutes to talk more about Representative Martha McSally and the results in the 2nd Congressional District with Jim Ninsel, executive editor of Tucson Weekly and Tucson Local Media. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
So we started the conversation about the U.S. Senate race. What are we missing about Martha McSally? Is there something that you've seen as a reporter down there, a longtime political journalist, insights into Martha McSally? Is she going to be able to move to the middle if she wants to?
Well, I don't know that she'll want to move to the middle. There's not much time to do that, and she's already moved from the middle to the pretty far right. I mean, she was representing a very competitive congressional district down here in southern Arizona, one of the most competitive in the nation, and she had really developed a moderate persona while representing this district, at least in her public comments. Her voting record was pretty conservative. However, she would say a lot of things or dodge a lot of tough questions that would really put her on the spot. And then we saw this transformation of her as she decided to run for the U.S. Senate, and suddenly she was embracing Donald Trump, which she had not done during her congressional campaign. In fact, she had criticized him after the Access Hollywood tape came out, said she wasn't going to endorse him, wouldn't even say if she had voted for him. So we're seeing a much different Martha McSally on the campaign trail than the people in southern Arizona were introduced to when she first got into the political game back in 2012.
Jim, how's that going over in her soon-to-be former congressional district, which, as you said, is a fairly moderate swing-type district?
Well, I don't know that it really matters how it's going over, since she has now no longer has to worry about the voters down here. But I think that it's not a big surprise to a lot of people who were concerned about where she was coming from with her voting record down here. I think she's just something of a political chameleon, but I think you could say the same thing about Kyrsten Sinema.
Jim, let's talk about who might be replacing her in the 2nd Congressional District. We had competitive races on both sides on Tuesday. Former Congresswoman Ann Kirkpatrick won on the Democratic side. Let's start with that race. It got pretty nasty toward the end. We heard on primary night the Pima County Democratic chair calling for party unity. Do you get the sense that that's possible after what was said and done during that primary?
Yeah, I think it is, only because if there's one thing Democrats are worried about at this point, it's Donald Trump, and their dislike for him will probably make them crawl across Cholla spines in order to vote for a Democrat in this November election. I think what you're right, though, the race did get very contentious. Matt Hines, a former state lawmaker who's run for this office, this congressional office before, came out and started hammering away at Ann Kirkpatrick, and she responded with about 10 times as many mailers as and ads that Matt was able to get out. She really just clobbered the guy after he went negative against her.
And Jim, briefly before we let you go, let's talk about the Republican side. Leah Marquez Peterson had some name recognition. She also seemed to have a lot more money than her opponent, barely squeaked this out. Based on the fact this has been a swing district, is Ann Kirkpatrick's name recognition going to be enough? Is she going to have more money? How do you expect this one to turn out?
You know, they're both going to have a lot of money. There's going to be a lot of outside money that comes pouring into this district. And I think depending on how much of that money comes in, we'll have some idea of what the polls are showing. It's going to be a tight race because it is a competitive district. Ann Kirkpatrick has to still overcome the notion that she is not really from Southern Arizona. Of course, before she'd lived up in Flagstaff and represented Congressional District 1. So there is this sense that she's sort of a carpetbagger. Leah Marquez Peterson is already highlighting her own deep roots in Southern Arizona and election night. That's what she was talking about. But she's got an uphill battle when you look around the country and you've seen what's happened in all these special elections where things have swung about 10, 15 or more points in the direction of Democrats. If that happens down here and Kirkpatrick's a shoo-in.
That's Jim Nintzel, executive editor of Tucson Weekly and Tucson Local Media. Nintz, thanks.
Hey, thank you guys so much.
And the Friday Newscap will continue right after this with Bob Robb and Jim Small in a moment. Thanks for listening to the Friday Newscap here on 91.5 KJZZ with Mark Brody in Phoenix. We're also joined by Bob Robb of the Arizona Republic and longtime political journalist Jim Small. Bob, major blowout in the Secretary of State GOP primary. Michelle Reagan was not faring well in polls we had seen first couple of years, a lot of missteps, but she got blown away by more than 30 points by a newcomer to Arizona politics. What do you make of that?
That Arizona voters are unforgiving of people who screw up elections. We saw that with Helen Purcell, and we've seen that with Michelle Reagan. Obviously, Steve Gaynor had a lot of money. He had very little understanding that he exhibited of what the Secretary of State's office did. So the notion that he wanted to spend $1 million of his own dollars because he badly wanted to be Secretary of State never quite rang true. But I don't think this was a pro-Gaynor vote. This was punishment for screwing up elections, and the people of Arizona have shown a unforgiving attitude towards that.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think that Michelle Reagan was beset by self-inflicted scandal after scandal, I mean, almost from the moment she took office. That Prop 123 election that was right after, you know, she got in. It was the first test. I mean, there were issues with that. There were just every time they turned around, it seemed that there were problems that were going on and mismanagement in that office. Whether it's, you know, pamphlets or websites or whatever. I definitely agree. She may not have been the one to blame for what happened, you know, going back to that presidential preference election that is, you know, so enraged people and understandably so. She didn't have anything to do with that. But at the same time, you know, you're going to get some blame for it. I think that was almost unavoidable. And she was outspent about 10 to 1. Not 10 to 1, but about 3 to 1, I think, in terms of total money. I mean, Steve Gaynor put in about $1.5 million of his own dollars, ran what seemed to be a pretty effective campaign. Michelle Reagan had 4 years to prepare for this race and didn't seem to have, you know, really come into it well-equipped to defend herself and run against a serious challenger, and I think that this is the result.
Well, Jim, so we've heard that there might be some outside money coming in for the Democratic candidate, Katie Hobbs, who did not have a primary for this race. Do you see this as a race that Democrats could pick up a statewide office?
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. I mean, and I think it all depends, you know, certainly, as we were talking about in the last segment, you know, there is an inherent advantage for Republicans in this state, and especially at statewide races. That said, you know, if there is going to be a wave year, if there's going to be a surge of Democratic voters and you know, Democratic candidates performing well, that's going to hit all levels of the ballot. And Secretary of State is definitely one where it's it will hit. It all depends, I think, on really what happens from the top down. You know, you have the governor's race and you have the U.S. Senate race. And so that's where most of the money is going to be, and you're going to have a coattails effect going down the ticket. Certainly Steve Gaynor, I think has opened himself up to some attacks. I mean, in the Trump era, and in the fact that one of his campaign planks was basically doing away with federal law that requires ballots to be printed in multiple languages to aid in the ability of people who don't speak English as their first language to be able to vote. That's something that it has already opened him up to attacks. He's already been criticized and attacked from the left on that. I imagine that that's going to be something that continues. There aren't many solid policy positions, I don't think, he took during the campaign, and that was one of them. And so I think that's one that is, we're going to probably be hearing a lot more about. But the difficulty is always going to be in a race like this to break through the noise. When you have two other more prominent races that are going to be attracting tens of millions of dollars into them, breaking through that noise and getting some attention for Katie Hobbs as opposed to just vote Democratic, I think is always going to be the challenge.
Bob, how do you see this race playing out?
Down ballot races have been decided by party registration pretty uniformly in the state going back to 2008. There have been exceptions. Dave Garcia made an exception in the superintendent of public instruction rate in 2014. You need to have a weak candidate, and Michelle Reagan, I think, would have been a prime target for that. Whether Gaynor is, I don't know. But for there to be a blue wave that goes down ballot, I think two things have to happen. You have to have not just an increase in Democratic turnout, you have to have a large increase in independent turnout. And independents need to channel their anti-Trump sentiment into not only the federal races, but the non-federal races. And the extent to which independents will turn out, the extent to which they will list Democratic, the extent to which that phenomenon will go now down ballot are the big imponderables that will probably determine whether Hobbs has a chance.
Big imponderables. I like that.
Yeah, and not just Hobbs, but I mean, I think every other race down the ballot. I mean, superintendent of public instruction, like you just mentioned, that's another one where, I think this year Democrats see an opportunity, and even down in the legislative races, all of those things really do depend on all those things Bob just said.
Well, Jim, superintendent's going to be really interesting to watch, because we all expect, even with InvestNet not getting on the ballot, we're expecting education to be an enormous issue in some, as far as legislative races and as far as statewide races are concerned as well. But we're seeing the fact that I think most of us would have thought David Shapiro would have won on the Democratic side. He did not. More experienced politician, losing to Kathy Hoffman. And then the Republican side, Diane Douglas lost in a narrow race. Maybe it was only narrow because there were so many candidates running. How big a deal is superintendent going to be in this case because education is going to be on everyone's minds?
Oh, I think it's definitely going to be a big deal. It would have been, I think, the ideal situation for Democrats would have been Diane Douglas, squeaking her way through that primary. She was definitely, they had a lot of, I think some track record performance in office to hang on her. Realistically, I think, this is going to be another one of those races where, unlike 4 years ago where you had Diane Douglas, who I think even the establishment Republicans identified as someone who they did not really want to be representing them, and they were...
Chamber of Commerce even came out to support Garcia.
They supported Garcia, some more, less, less enthusiastically than others, but there was an amount of support from the establishment, Republican establishment, for Garcia that I don't know if we're going to see that this time. I think the Democrats are really going to have to carry themselves in this race going forward. I've just in conversations with people involved on both sides of the aisle, in campaign world, they don't see a lot of, they see this as really kind of an open race. Hoffman is generally unknown, but she comes from the classroom. She's got a teaching background. And then you've got guys like Riggs and Branch and the Republicans worked really hard to kind of align themselves with Trump. And so any kind of negative Trump effect that you're going to have is going to go with them as well. And so, are they going to be viewed as really pro-education? Are they going to be viewed as skeptical of the education infrastructure, and would a teacher be better suited to run that department? I think really the questions voters are going to have to ponder.
Bob, how significant is it, do you think, in terms of making education an election issue, the fact that the Invest in Education measure will not be on the ballot?
I think it actually will help the debate, because that would have sucked up all the oxygen. That would have been what the debate was about. Now you have an open slate, and so Doug Ducey has the ability to make his case, and his case is improving. His state revenues improve, that we can get the job done for education without raising taxes. And now David Garcia has to come up with a plan. It's not enough to say that I support teachers and you don't, or I support public education and you don't. He now needs to say, here's how much more I think that we should invest in education, and here's how I propose to raise it. So I actually think we'll have a better debate over education as a result of Invest in Ed not being on the ballot.
Jim, were you surprised at all at the fact that when the state Supreme Court took up the initiatives, the Invest in Ed, the Dirty Money one, and the Clean Energy one, the justices did not take up the issue itself of, quote-unquote, strict compliance? They sort of left that for another day. Were you surprised by that? Do you think it will – how big of an impact do you think that will have on initiative efforts going forward?
I mean, it's the law. So it is already having an effect on it, and it will continue to, I mean, until and unless a court says otherwise or the legislature says otherwise. Courts are always, you know, oftentimes loath to go any further than they absolutely minimally need to in order to resolve a case. And so if there is a way to get a case done and finished without having to necessarily tackle the big issue there, oftentimes you'll see courts do that. And I think that, you know, in this case, there were other issues. There were other things that were germane and that were defects, really, that led to, you know, the Invest in Ed initiative in particular being removed from the ballot. So that way they could just stop there, say, okay, we've got a resolution. We already know we're going to take it off the ballot for this reason. We don't need to go all the way and decide this other issue because it's irrelevant to the matter at hand.
It may be premature to conclude that the court won't address that issue. It wasn't in the very short synopses that we received
what
they had it. And so they simply cited the statutes that they used to strike down the two that they did strike down. But one of the first things that any opinion does is to say, here's our standard of review. I don't know that they will finally definitively decide. They may say, well, we don't need to reach that because even on this other standard of review that we've always used. But I believe it will be at least addressed indirectly, if not fully and comprehensively, because that's just the way they write their decisions. That's the first thing they said. What's the standard of review that we're going to use here?
Now, Bob and Jim, in our last couple of minutes, let's look at the legislature. One of our themes today has been that incumbents lost. We saw Diane Douglas lose, presumably. Michelle Reagan definitely lose. Tom Farese losing and trying to get reelected CorpCom. We also saw some upsets of incumbents running for the legislature. And as people are wondering to see whether Democrats can actually gain seats or not, even if we're going to see different faces, do you expect, based on the results we saw Tuesday, that maybe there is a better or worse chance of Democrats maybe tying the Senate, maybe gaining some seats in the House?
Most of the hugely vulnerable Republicans did lose in the primaries. So sort of having the walking wounded on the general election ballot, there's not a lot of that, except perhaps Dave Gowen in southern Arizona. I still believe that the prospects of Democrats in down-ballot races and in the legislative races is almost entirely dependent upon how large of an independent turnout you have, how strong of a blue tint it has, and whether it holds their antipathy against Trump against Republicans down-ballot.
Yeah, I mean, Democrats, I think, stand a good chance to pick up some seats in the House. I know at one time, maybe 5 or 6 months ago, there was a wild thought that maybe they can take over the chamber. I don't know that it's really shaping up that way anymore. It doesn't seem to be. But, you know, and in terms of the Senate, I mean, there's, you're always going to have a narrow margin. I mean, Republicans are going to be up by one or two or maybe three seats there, and so you've got some wiggle room and some competitive races. But again, everything really has to go right, and best case scenario for Democrats really might be a split Senate, might be a 15-15. But that's, again, if everything goes perfect and you know, all of those down ballot races kind of break the correct way. And it's, again, breaking through that noise is going to be very difficult. You're almost at that low level of the ballot, subject to the whims of kind of the national, kind of the general electorate mood, as opposed to, in a lot of cases, those specific issues in that specific race.
Well, in our last minute left or so, that's what I'm wondering about, the InvestNet impact, the fact that there was some passion at least shown yesterday when there was this protest outside the Supreme Court. If, in fact, that factors in a few legislative races, just a few, Bob, to make sure that people say, well, at least I wanted to have a chance to vote on InvestNet. I don't. Maybe I'm going to support someone who seems more pro-education funding in the legislature.
I didn't get the sense that the passion in the Red for Ed movement transferred over to InvestNet. The movement was kind of hijacked by some people with a redistributionist economic policy, and you just didn't seem to have the same enthusiasm for that. So I think it's more likely, to the extent it exists, to be funneled into the governor's race.
Yeah, I think you could, depending on what the district is, what the issue is, who the candidates are. I mean, I think you could definitely see some issues, some districts where teachers are able to mobilize and able to maybe recapture some of that energy and direct it at a particular legislator, maybe someone who they didn't like, or where there's a tight race and you know, the teachers groups are able to really marshal their energy.
Longtime political journalist Jim Small and Bob Robb of the Arizona Republic, thanks for joining us for a busy newscap this week.
Good to be with
you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at the show@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.